Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Burry is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be exploring the wonders of fungi, one of the most amazing organisms on Earth, but also talking about the very serious threat which they pose to the human race. In part two, we'll be hearing about an upcoming performance of Mozart's sparkling comedy, Così fan tutte, by the Brew City Opera. Here's part one. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about something that is all around us, in fact, very much a part of our lives. In fact, one of the things that makes life possible, and yet also something that poses grave threats to the human race as well. I am talking about fungi, an extraordinary sort of organism, and one much more closely related to human beings than we might ever imagine. Something that, as I said, has made life possible and also is posing increasing threats to us and to our survival. I have been reading a fascinating new book called What If Fungi Win? The author of this book, Dr. Arturo Casadevall, is a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. He has focused on fungi and fungal diseases for decades and is one of our leading experts on this important part of the natural world. And this very, very interesting new book not only, in a sense, celebrates the wonder of fungi, but also is a very sobering alarm call in terms of the concern that all of us should have about our preparedness for these increasing threats. The book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press, again titled, What If Fungi Win? And Dr. Arturo Casadevall, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book is full of surprises. One of them is the story that you tell that helps us understand why you have devoted so much of your life and energy and passion to the study of fungi. It is a surprising story because it involves something that we think of as having no relationship whatsoever to fungi, namely AIDS. Tell us about your real-life experience that fueled so much of your interest in this.
So when I was in medical school in the 1980s, what were the big problems we were focused on at the time? We were focused on things like cancer, degenerative diseases, Alzheimer's disease, and I was made a decision to go into research, and I was going to almost certainly work in one of those problems. And then something totally unexpected happened, and that was the HIV pandemic. So this virus came out of nowhere, and it began to kill people, young people that didn't have any medical conditions. And what was happening was the virus was weakening their immune system, and they were dying of fungal diseases. And to me, that was, you could say, my medical formative experience, taking care of patients with AIDS in the mid-1980s, when we could not do very much about the virus. So the idea at the time was maybe we should do better with these diseases. So I went into fungal diseases because of my experiences in New York in the late 1980s when I saw lots of people die, and then we felt very helpless as to what we could do.
Hmm. Let's circle back to something even more basic now and talk about what fungi are and their relationship to other living things on Earth. It's important for our listeners to understand that fungi are, in a sense, their own distinct kingdom of organisms. That is, they are not animals, they are not plants. They are something very, very quite distinct. And your book tells us that it's only relatively recently that that determination, in a sense, was finally and officially made, that fungi had their own kingdom, that we needed to think of them as distinctly as that. Tell us more about that discovery or that realization.
So for most of history, where did you see fungi? You see them as mushrooms. They come out of the ground. Although they have colors in some cases, people thought they were a form of plants. And what happened beginning in the 1960s and throughout the years afterwards, is the scientists began to apply molecular techniques to understanding their origin. And what they found was, like you said it so beautifully, they're not plants, they're not animals, they're not bacteria, they are not protozoa, you know, like amoeba, they are something totally different. They are their own kingdom. They are a group of organisms that just like we are as different from plants, we're as different, plants are as different from them. Now, here's the rub. When they looked at the molecular similarities, they are much more like us than we are to plants or to amoeba or something like that. So they are, in fact, our closest relatives.
And as your book says a little later on, which we'll get to, this poses some problems when it comes to being able to contend with some of the ways in which fungi can be a threat to us. I want to circle back, though, to something else you say about fungi, which is so intriguing and worth exploring for just a few minutes. You tell us at one point in your book, fungi are magnificent life forms, remarkable and awe-inspiring, beautiful in their own way, and endlessly fascinating to learn about. Now, if one is encountering fungi when it comes to something like mildew in the shower or athlete's foot or a smut that is destroying some of our favorite plants or whatever it might be, the word magnificent might be the last word we would choose. But you who have studied fungi for so long clearly have a deep appreciation for all that makes these organisms in so many ways remarkable, magnificent, even beautiful. Tell us more about this aspect of fungi and what inspires you to describe them in these kind of glowing terms.
So anybody who walks in the woods and looks at mushrooms would be impressed by their beauty, their symmetry, their ability to grow rapidly. You know, it rains and they sprout the next day. You are absolutely right that mildew and mold growing in a house is not pretty. But they are magnificent in a different way. Their ability to survive, their ability to resist all kinds of environmental stresses allows them to be so resilient that whenever we have any human cataclysm. I mean, think about Katrina. The fungi take over. The houses have to be destroyed, not because they got flooded. They have to be destroyed because mold is growing in them. So I think the word magnificence here is an admiration of the whole kingdom that ranges from the beauty that we can sometimes see on a walk in the forest to this remarkable ability to survive in very, very unusual conditions.
Explain what all of these fungi have in common? Because, of course, I think that's one of the things that is maybe most bewildering, maybe one of the facets of all this that makes it sort of impenetrable to those of us who are civilians, and that is the extraordinary range and variety of fungi. And yet they all share something in common that ties them all together and groups them within this single kingdom. Explain what that is that ties them all together and kind of the nature of that common denominator.
So the fungi are thought to have emerged separated from us, we the animals, about a billion years ago, give or take, you know, half a billion. Those dates are too hard to pin down. But you ask me what makes them unique and what makes them different. So on one level, they are like us. If you take a look at a microscope and you look at the fungal cells, they have nucleus. They have a nucleus in there. That's very different than bacteria. Bacteria don't have nucleus. But what really makes them different is that their metabolism, that is their ability to process foods, digest foods, break down foods, it's in a class of its own. That differentiates them from being animals, that differentiates them from being plants, which, as you know, are green because they have photosynthesis. So if you can ask me to put it in one word, it will be metabolism. Their metabolism, that is the sum of all the biochemical reactions and all the ways that they reproduce and grow, is in a class of its own.
Of course, one of the aspects of fungi that you spend some time talking about in your book is the way in which fungi make life possible for us and provide tremendous benefits to human beings all over the planet and in a number of different ways. Sketch for us at least a couple of those most important ways in which, in a sense, fungi are among our most precious friends when it comes to making life on this planet possible.
Right. So the most important thing that fungi do in on Earth is that they recycle nutrients. What do I mean by that? Imagine a tree falls in the forest. That tree is full of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, amino acids, and all that. How do you get that back into the environment that such that other creatures can use it for growth? Well, this is something what the fungi excel at. They break down biological matter. And in doing so, they keep the flow of nutrients going. And that allows, they make them available for others. And that is probably the single most important role of the fungal kingdom on Earth right now. I think that if we did not have fungi, life may still be possible on Earth, but it will not be anything like we know it.
Your book, by the way, makes passing reference to something that is quite fascinating to me, and that is not only the possibility, but the probability, maybe in some cases even the reality, of fungi being able to play a role in the breakdown of plastics, which, of course, we all know by now is a real scourge when it comes to the environment around us. Just tell us briefly about this intriguing possibilities that of fungi playing a role when it comes to breaking down the plastics that are all around us.
So our civilization, one of the characteristics of it is that we make materials that biology can't break down, at least break down very easily. Good example for that are plastics. Now, if you want things to last, that's great. But when these things become waste, they're a huge problem for the whole planet, including us. So many researchers are very intrigued at the fungal capacity of breaking down things. And they have been trying to identify species that can break down plastics, and they're partially successful. There are some fungal species that will accelerate the breakdown of plastics, and that is good because what they're doing is they're breaking down the plastic to release the carbon, the oxygen, the nitrogens that are in it, and make that available for other living creatures.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Arturo Casadevall, who is author of a new book called What If Fungi Win? Dr. Casadevall teaches at Johns Hopkins University in the Bloomberg School of Public Health. His book, What If Fungi Win? Examines what fungi are, their relationship to human beings, both in positive ways, as we have been talking about, and in some ways that are deeply concerning, troubling, dangerous on all kinds of different levels. So first of all, tell us in the most general sort of terms the circumstances under which fungi can be a negative presence in our lives, and then the way in which some of this is worsening in our current situation.
So probably the greatest negative impact that fungi currently have is that they destroy crops. And some people have estimated that fungal losses per year is enough to feed a quarter of humanity. So they destroy our food. And when you think about what we are dependent on, we are dependent on a few grains. So we get a lot of our calories from a few grains. And one of the big things that many of us fear is, what if you were to get fungal strains destroying these crops all at the same time? So that could pose a tremendous challenge to humanity, because there are close to 8 billion of us, and, you know, food supplies have been increasing, but they've been increasing primarily because of what we call the Green Revolution, making crops that are more resistant, that can grow faster, that can do better. Certainly, if a fungal pathogen was to threaten them, it would pose a tremendous danger to us.
Hmm. And you point out in your book some examples, and some of us may have heard about some of these, especially the way in which certain types of bananas have been absolutely decimated by,
exactly,
by fungal diseases.
Almost driven to extinction. I mean, I should add to that that, you know, why this is why we need research, in the sense that there are people working to make things fungal resistant. And there are people trying to understand how to neutralize the fungi. But, you know, it's always a battle. There is no letdown. Mm-hmm. You know, the moment you generate a new strain of wheat, you basically have to deal with a new threat to it.
Right. You, of course, talk about the way in which various fungi have been a devastating presence in the animal kingdom. And I know here in Wisconsin, we have heard something about white nose syndrome that has killed many, many bats, and actually bats by the millions. You kind of explain a bit about this particular instance, and that's just one example. We could talk about frogs, we could talk about dogs, many, many different animals. But maybe we could just take a moment talking about this particular fungal attack on bats, and maybe also what we have learned about it in terms of trying to combat this kind of a threat.
So to put it in perspective, think about viruses. Viruses need you to replicate. So viruses often don't kill every last individual when there is a pandemic, obviously, because if they did so, they eliminate their ability to replicate. Fungi don't care. When fungi get into a pond where there are frogs, this chytrid fungus, it kills all the frogs. The bats in North America were doing well up to 2006, and then a fungus was introduced. Many people think that it may have been introduced by people from other countries, came from other countries carrying it in their boots. This fungus has decimated North American bats. Millions have died. The bats reproduce slowly. So making up these losses is not going to happen probably in our lifetime. And the fascinating thing is that the bats are resistant in the summer. In the summer, their temperature is like you and me, 37 degrees centigrade or 98 degrees Fahrenheit. But in the winter, they, because there are no insects, they hibernate. They drop their temperature to about 10 to 12 degrees. And that's when the fungus attacks. And it's killing them by the millions. And this has all kinds of repercussions, as we mentioned. Basically, the fewer bats, the fewer insects get eaten, the more insects, the more damage to crops, bites on people, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. Can you remind me, by the way, I have heard this information, but I am not now remembering. What is it exactly that happens that actually kills the bat? Why is it that they die from this?
So the bats are, a lot of work from scientists at the U.S. Wildlife Service has worked out what we call the pathogenesis of infection. So the bats are social, and because they're social, they spread it from one to the other. So it begins in the skin. And what this fungus does is it damages the skin. And when it damages the skin, the bats begin to lose fluids. So they wake up in the middle of winter, and there is no food. So the combination of being attacked by this fungus, the lack of food, they die by the millions. And people have reported walking into this cave where you had an enormous bat colony, and the floor is covered with dead bats.
Mm. Just tragic. You mentioned, by the way, as you talk about this, that someone not far from where I'm speaking to you, Bruce Klein at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is one of a number of people who are working very hard to come up with vaccines that might help with some of this. And it sounds like you are a friend of Professor Klein,
Bruce,
and admire the work that he has done thus far.
Bruce is one of the greatest scientists of our time. And what he's done in recent years is put his efforts to try to make a vaccine to protect the bats. Now, think how hard that's going to be, right? Vaccinating bats. But, you should have him in your program sometime. He's very clever ways in which they're trying to figure out how to get this to bats. And, I can think of nothing more nobler. Here we are, right, trying to save a fellow species using whatever science we have. To do so.
And of course, your book is not just about fungal threats to creatures like frogs and dogs and bats and so on, but it is also about some of the new threats that we as human beings more directly face. That is the way in which fungal diseases are on the rise in the human population in some ways that are truly frightening. At one point in your book, as you explore this, you talk about what you call a paradox when it comes to the relationship between human beings and fungi. This is how you open chapter 5. There's a paradox in modern medicine that could be upending the truce between fungi and humans. The great irony is that the incredible medical advances of the last 50-plus years are actually making humans more susceptible to dangerous fungi. Explain more about the nature of this paradox, as you put it.
So great advances in medicine often come at the price of immunity. Let's unpack that a little bit. When people have cancer and they are treated for their cancer, the cancer sometimes makes them immunosuppressed. When people have a failing organ and they get their organ, an organ transplant, you have to keep down immunity so the new organ doesn't get rejected. Some of the autoimmune diseases require drugs that lower immunity. So as medicine makes progress, and I'm a big fan of the great progress that we're making in so many fields, it is coming with a price, and the price is that we have more and more individuals with some impairment in their defenses. And these individuals are a greater risk for fungal diseases.
Hmm. You are telling us in this book about certain threats that are especially troubling. One that I believe has the name of Candida auris, A-U-R-I-S, which you... and the news of this, you say, is both mysterious and alarming. And it was something that has probably been around for a long time, but something now has changed and makes this a very, very significant threat to us. Explain.
So let's unpack this a little bit. So this is a fungus that was unknown to medicine. It was unknown to science up until 2009 when it began turning up on patients. So it's not like it was there and we missed it. No, this was new. And the mystery is that it emerges simultaneously in three continents, South America, Africa, and Asia. And the strains are not related. It's not like somebody took a plane from South America to Africa and brought it along. These things are de novo emergences. And the question is, what's going on here? You have a fungus that is unknown. You have a fungus that is now emerging in very, very different places. And some of us have proposed that the only common denominator is global warming. So how could this all be related? Well, think of what I said. Our temperatures protect us against most fungal species. Most of the fungi in the environment simply cannot tolerate our temperatures. But the world is getting warmer, and the fungi are adapting. So you can imagine that out there, some of them are adapting to higher temperatures. And if that happens, we are going to lose our heat protection. And Candida auris may be the canary in the coal mine. It's the first one to basically have broken through. And if that is the case, and, you know, I don't want to be alarmist, but I want people to be aware of this possibility, is that as this century gets warmer and we have more and more hot days, think about it, every day when the temperature goes over 100 degrees, that's a selection event. All the organisms in the environment need to adapt. That we are going to get new fungal diseases. And some of those diseases will be shocking to medicine because we will have no prior experience with it.
You call this moment a crossroads moment in the existence of life as we know it on this planet, talking about the dimensions of this challenge. And, of course, you are one of a number of scientists who are studying fungi and doing everything you possibly can to enlarge our understanding of fungi and to help us maybe break the code and maybe unravel some of the mystery that still is a part of the kingdom of fungi. But in your book, you say something really interesting about the scientific community. And I think this is something that is worth talking about for a moment. You say that in some ways, the way the scientific community operates is counterproductive, particularly in the way in which we encourage specialization that occurs too early in the lifetime of a given scientist. Explain the problem with specialization and how we maybe need to be careful and maybe need to rethink the way in which we train and deploy our scientists when it comes to a challenge like fungi.
I'm so glad you brought that up because that is, you know, one of the things that I think a lot about. And the question and the issue is as follows. In the past, when you think about Marie Curie, when you think about Albert Einstein, when you think about Charles Darwin, people were very broadly trained, usually in the classics, in social sciences, what are now the social sciences, and then they specialized. And when you think about their discoveries, they were able to bring, they were generalists before they became specialists. Today, because science has become so large and so complicated, we have lost that. So what we do today is we specialize first. You go into college, you get your degree in physics. You get to college, you get your chemistry. And then when you get to graduate school, we further specialize. And therefore, it's wonderful because we are creating individuals who are capable of doing very deep work in their fields. But some of the challenges that we're facing, let's just talk about Candida auris, requires a generalist perspective. you need to be able to think about climate change. You need to be able to think about geography. You need to be able to think about patients. You need to be able to think about fungi. And I think that it is very important that as humanity goes forward and it's meeting some of this crisis that we're dealing with, that we figure out a way to preserve what is good in current scientific training, that is, to preserve the ability to teach somebody. Take a 22-year-old right off college, and that's a generic age. I realize that some people are older and some people are younger, and train them with a PhD, but also give them the tools so that they can communicate with the public. Give them the tools so that they can read outside their fields. And I think if they do that, we're going to be better prepared because the problems ahead are all interdisciplinary. And at Hopkins, we actually began a new program. We call it the R3. It stands for Rigor, Reproducibility, and Responsibility, that is trying to do just that.
So the hope is that our scientific understanding will enlarge, and with that also many, many more tools can be developed, including antifungal medications to help combat some of the concerns that we have talked about. At one point in your book, you say, I want to help change the way we practice science.
That's correct. I think that, you know, I'm obviously biased, but I think science is humanity's greatest invention, and I think science is humanity's best insurance policy. I think going forward. And therefore, we need to train scientists in ways in which they can meet these challenges. And I think what we need is to train scientists as capable of doing deep work, which is what they can do now, and then give them the tools to be generalists. So they can. So when you confront them with a problem, they say, that's not my field. You don't want them to say, that's not my field. You want them to say, okay, so how do we approach it?
And how do we approach this? Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you confront the scientists, you know, In with a topic, you often what they say, you know, that's not my field. But I would say being a scientist should be more of a generalist. One should have an appreciation of the total problems in nature and then be able to bring in what else is needed to solve the problem. And I think that can be taught. I think that can be taught, and we can do it without compromising the great scientific teaching structures that we have in our universities.
Right. And of course, when it comes to the kind of problems that we are talking about on a global scale that threaten all of us, it becomes even more important to have scientists that are well-trained and able to collaborate to create the solutions that will preserve life as we know it. The book, again, is What If Fungi Win? And the book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and the author, Dr. Arturo Casadevall. Dr. Casadevall, thank you so much, first of all, for the great work that you have done in this field, and thank you for explaining that work so effectively in your fascinating book. I was really privileged to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the delicious music of Mozart, a little bit of the overture to his comedy Così fan tutte in a chamber arrangement by the Berlin Philharmonic Winds. This comedy by Mozart, one of his last operas actually, a brilliant masterpiece in so many ways, is going to be performed this coming weekend by a group known as Brew City Opera, with performances Thursday and Friday evening, and then Saturday afternoon and evening at Next Act Theater in Milwaukee. And I'm happy to be speaking via telephone with Edson Melendez, who is one of the directors of this production. And he's going to be talking about Mozart's Così fan tutte, this wonderful, entertaining comedy, and also talking about Brew City Opera and its mission. Edson Melendez, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me on. It's great to speak with you again.
A lot of people know the work that you've done in a lot of different ventures, including work that you've done with the group Bell Ensemble. Brew City Opera is something that, of course, as its name indicates, focuses more specifically on opera and has a mission that I think is so commendable. Explain to our listeners when Brew City Opera was created and the purpose behind creating this opera company.
Sure. Brew City Opera began in 2019 with an inaugural production of Carmen. And it is sort of the brain and passion child of Tim Reavers and myself. And one of the things that we began to see is that people were becoming frustrated with not having enough opportunity to perform opera. Now, we have a wealth of talented people in Southeast Wisconsin who, you know, are worthy to be seen on national and international stage, and for a variety of reasons have decided to call Milwaukee home. So we call ourselves a Milwaukee or Southeast Wisconsin-centric company, and we hire locally. And the thing that's really great is that we get people who are just coming out of their university training and need experience on stage, need to build their resumes, need to build their repertoire list. And then we have those who, you know, may have been out of the game, if you will, for 15, 20 years, who now have the time to rededicate to this, who are coming back. So we're really proud that we get to provide that type of opportunity to that range of people. You know, it's also really great to have those younger folks on stage with those who, you know, have been around the block in terms of their work output. There's a lot to be said and gained from sharing the stage with somebody who's been doing it for a while.
Absolutely. So you have chosen for your next production this wonderful comedy by Mozart, Così fan tutte, without a doubt one of his masterpieces. One of the things that's always intrigued me about Così fan tutte is that although now it's a very central part of the repertoire, there were many years that it did not get done all that often. I don't think it reached the stage of the Metropolitan Opera until the early 20th century. And it sounds like that a lot of people shied away from it because they thought it was almost a little too risque. And I think it's wonderful to think about an opera by Mozart that would actually be, in a sense, too shocking for people.
Yeah. That is absolutely true. It, you know, it has, even in our production, it does have its moments that are, you know, that if you're an adult, you go, ooh, okay. It was shocking to some people, but it was always intended to be a comedy. It was always intended to capture the youth and a certain, you know, vigor of youth that these characters have. So. Yeah, I mean you're absolutely right that it was not as popular as Marriage for a long time, but once it came back, it's been hard to stop.
Oh, it's incredible. And of course, it's perfect for Brew City Opera in that it's a relatively intimate opera, that is it really has a cast of 6 and it can be done in a relatively intimate space, and I know that's one of the things that at least to some extent, has been part of some of Brew City's work. It feels like a work that was written for Brew City Opera to do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a budding company, we do have to be very conscious of, you know, cast size and things like that, because we do pay our artists. Not what they should be paid, but we pay them as well as we can. And so that type of thing works. And then, of course, the story is ultimately intimate because of those 6 characters. You're not dealing with, you know, grand political things like you might be doing with Clemenza di Tito or something like that. You really are focused on the story of these 6 people and really two couples and then a couple who is not an amorous couple, but a couple of people who like to pull strings who are very, very funny.
Mm.
You know, another thing that Bruce City is proud of is that we do these kind of intimate productions, and we also charge very little in comparison to some other companies that are doing the same repertoire.
Mm.
Tickets for this show are $25 for the general seating, $35 for the premier seating, as we call it. Which is, you know, more than half the price of the less premier seats at some of the bigger companies in, you know, Wisconsin and Illinois.
We're speaking with Edson Melendez about Bruce City Opera and about their production that is coming up this weekend of Mozart's Così fan tutte. So let's have you give a crack at summarizing the wonderful plot of Così fan tutte, or at least set up what happens at the outset of this really entertaining opera.
Yeah, so the opera begins with what is one of my favorite male trios in all of opera, where the distinguished gentleman, we'll call him Don Alfonso, is... basically making a bet that that the lovers, Ferrando and Guglielmo, that their girlfriends, fiancés, it's really quite unclear what they are, would be unfaithful to them. And the gentlemen are saying, no, that wouldn't happen, not my Dorabella and Fiordiligi. And then they have a little bit of a soft spot for gambling. So he says, well, let's put some money on it. And they say, okay. And they then pretend to go off to war, leaving their beloveds behind, and come back dressed as these flashy strangers and attempt to woo each other's girlfriends. And it is really quite funny because they come back in, you know, with fake facial hair and in garishly loud costumes. And it is just really quite funny. Now, they come into a moment where even they get a little bit uncomfortable and don't know how to proceed with some of these things. But ultimately... it ends up well. I won't share too much more of how the action plays out because that's where all the good stuff is.
Exactly. So one of the things, as you said, that is a central mission of Bruce City Opera is that you are utilizing the talent of wonderful singers who are based right here in southeastern Wisconsin. And I know that at least a couple of your singers are going to be quite well known to some WGTD listeners. Tell our listeners about the wonderful singers who comprise your cast.
Well, we have two casts, or at least a few of the roles are covered, but our principal cast is Tabitha Stigi as Fiordiligi, Brennan Martinez as Dorabella, Tomas Dominguez as Ferrando, Ryan White as Guglielmo, Dan Kirkman as Don Alfonso, and Anya Pustover as Despina. And then our cover cast for Fiordiligi, Dorabella, and Guglielmo are Kaisa, Herman, sorry, Adlai Kim, and Maggie Moyer.
Hmm. I know that a lot of our listeners saw the production of Sweeney Todd at the Racine Theater Guild, year before last and our last year, and Tabitha Stegi had a very important role in that and has been on that stage before. And anybody who saw a recent performance of Carmina Burana with the Choral Arts Society heard Ryan White dispatching the really, really difficult baritone solos wonderfully well. So a couple of your performers in particular will be quite familiar to our listeners. So you were kind of telling me off the air that this is a very, very challenging week with night after night devoted to final rehearsals. How are things feeling as opening night approaches?
They are feeling really, really, really good. We have our final dress rehearsal tonight, and the show is just so charming. One of the things that we really worked very diligently on is keeping the show light, energetic, young, and most of all, funny. We had a couple people in the house last night that weren't part of, you know, the production, and there were more than just chuckles. It is a very, very funny show, very light show that is executed extremely well and does not cross that line into shticky. You know, it really is a universe that they are sharing with us that we get to see where within some very funny things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Another little thing about it is that we are doing this with a chamber orchestra. So we have four strings and then a harpsichord / pianoforte accompaniment for these numbers. So you get to hear more of what you would get in the, you know, large full production in that way. We were able to cut the show down because in its original form it is over 3.5 hours long. And we got our show down to just under 2 hours without missing any of the important stuff or any of the arias or big moments that you know, you go to see Cozy for.
Very good. And it sounds like you and Tim Rebers, together you created Brew City Opera, and you are music director and stage director, and it sounds like you are quite a team.
Yeah. Tim's a great guy, and, you know, we both have an undying, unwavering passion for this art form and for highlighting our local musicians who really are very, very, very worthy and very, very, very able. And, that, you know, that's important to both of us, and we get a lot of satisfaction from helping our colleagues do their work.
So performances are tomorrow night, that is Thursday night at 7, Friday night at 7, and then Saturday, two performances at 3 and 7 at Next Act Theater, which is 255 South Water Street in Milwaukee. What should people do if they are interested in tickets for any of these performances?
They can go to the ticket site on Next Act Theater's site. We have a link to it on our website, www.brewcityopera.com. And we also have links and all sorts of posts and preview shots and everything on our Facebook site, which is just Brew City Opera. Pop that in and we should top right up. And join us because it's going to be a fun show, and it is a beautiful show visually as well.
Wonderful. Edson Melendez, one of the directors of Brew City Opera's performance of Così fan tutte, their production, with four performances this weekend. Edson Melendez, we wish you and Tim Rebers and your cast and everyone involved in this production a successful run of performances of this wonderful comedy, Così fan tutte. And thanks for being my guest today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
It's 8:58 here on WGTD, and tomorrow on The Morning Show, our good friend Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events and issues. And on Friday, out of the archives, one of my all-time favorite interviews related to the sport of baseball, Heart of the Game, by Sports Illustrated writer S.L. Price. The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Our weather forecast is for sunny skies today, breezy conditions, a high of 69 degrees. Clear overnight with a low of 42. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 68 degrees. Friday, we should have sunshine in the morning and mostly sunny skies over the afternoon with a high of 76 degrees. Saturday is going to be a little cloudier, and there's a 40% chance of rain showers on Saturday with a high of 73. By Sunday, sunny and warming to 79. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.